This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaqui on Culture and Race, Part 5. We've discussed how Yaqui anthropomorphizes concepts, how he capitalizes their names, how he describes them and discusses them as if they're Greek titans fighting with one another, struggling with one another, as if they have a life of their own, thoughts of their own, goals of their own, concepts. That's how Yaqui discusses them. He did this with liberalism, and when we talked about liberalism, I remarked on that and thought it was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on why. And he said things like, at times, liberalism wants this or that, or liberalism opposes authority, as if it was actively trying to oppose authority, as if it had a life, a spirit of its own. And I cut him slack at that time because it was a new realization to me that he was using that technique, and also because people do that all the time, even intellectuals, writers who are trying to explain something will use poetic license and as a form of shorthand. And also, when you're trying one human being to another, trying to describe something complicated, it's often the case that out of convenience you fall back to expressing your idea in order to communicate it to your fellow human being in human terms. You thus anthropomorphize something, you, even though it's not totally appropriate to do so. And that's what I thought Yaqui was doing. But I see now that it's really a pattern throughout his book Imperium, and probably throughout his worldview, his whole life. He talks in Imperium about two ideas opposed to each other, these two titan-like ideas. And this is core to not only his ideas about race and culture, but the idea that he was laying out in his book Imperium and to his worldview. This was really central to it. I'll repeat here a few sentences that I read toward the end of the last installment. Two ideas are opposed, not concepts or abstractions, but ideas, capital I, which were in the blood of men before they were formulated by the minds of men. Skipping a bit forward, but the great to get at what these two ideas are. But the greatest opposition of all has not yet been named. The conflict, which will take up all the others into itself. This is the battle of the idea of the unity of the West, capital I, U, and W, idea of the unity of the West, against the nationalism of the 19th century. Here stand opposed the ideas of empire, capital E, and petty statism, large space thinking, and political provincialism. What he's doing here is asserting that what he describes as an idea is not an idea. It's not concept or abstraction, but it's material. It's in the blood. He likes to call his opposition, what he doesn't like, the position on the other side of what he's arguing, rationalism. He attributes it to rationalism, which means abstractions based on logic and reason. But he engages in it himself. In fact, here he's really abstracting. And in fact, he's going a bit beyond that. He, as I noticed in part 3 and commented there, he takes rational thought based on evidence based in reality, observing reality, and he calls that inorganic. But his intangible, immaterial, mystical philosophizing about capital ideas capital I ideas, he calls that organic thinking, inverting the sense of the word organic and inorganic. And here he's doing it with the word idea itself, saying that it's not a concept. The first time, again, I was thinking, okay, well, he's just trying to express himself. He's grasping to express the inexpressible. But I think it goes beyond that. I think he's twisting the meaning of words. It goes beyond poetic license. It goes beyond just trying to describe the indescribable. And into mysticism, it becomes detached from reality and inverts it in some senses, inverts the reality. It's not, what he's arguing is not based in fact, as he constantly harps on this need to be based in fact and reality, and yet he himself can't stay moored to facts and reality. On that part three installment in the comments section, Northside, I thought, wrote something very insightful about it. He said, Yaki exalts telos, ultimate purpose or state, in his cosmology, constructing his envisioned universe such that an, quote, organic, causal life force, existential source or basis of existence, causal life force there. You know, I don't work with these concepts every day or read them. Operates unilaterally upon the mean, quote, inorganic stuff of observable experience, which he debases. So, and he puts his finger on it there just to summarize. Yaki does, I think, arrogates telos, direction, purpose to his view of what drives the universe. And he debases, and he calls that organic, and he debases what is truly organic, calling it inorganic, and seeing it as being driven by, and not having a telos of its own, but being driven by the telos that he thinks, the direction, the ultimate purpose or state, that's driven by this capital I idea that he exalts. And he denies telos. He denies life, causality, to agency, to real, tangible people. And that's what causality means. It's the relationship between one event and another, one thing and another. What causes, which one causes the other? In this case, it's the question is, do ideas drive men to do what they do? Or do men drive the ideas? And Yaki comes down pretty strongly on ideas driving men to the exclusion of men driving ideas. And yet I think it's both. I would argue that it's both, and I would argue that Yaki himself is an example of how it's both. Here's a guy who talked about ideas and wanted to promote his ideas. And so he wrote a book, and he went out and argued with people and discussed with people and tried to organize political movements to promote his ideas, to make reality happen the way he wanted it to happen. Now, maybe he saw himself being driven by his own ideas, that he had no power over this. I think it's both. It's men drive the ideas, and the ideas drive men. Organic is really the inorganic plus something else, plus something ineffable. We call something that's organic life. So life is the inorganic, the material, plus something else. Maybe in Yaki's terms, you could call it an idea. The inorganic plus an idea equals the organic. To be charitable, give a charitable reading to what he's trying to express here. I think that the something is not, idea is not the best word for it, but consciousness is, or you could call it awareness, agency. And that this consciousness is what separates human life from inhuman life, and it also separates life from non-life. But even more important, it separates human life from other forms of life, from monkeys, for instance. Consciousness. Now, this is all as a precursor to Yaki's criticism of Darwinism, as we've already started to discuss. Let's get back to that critique of Darwinism on page 69. He writes, "The human soul itself, known as the brain in the 19th century, is only a tool by which a certain type of monkey advanced himself to man ahead of his fellow monkeys. Teleology again. Man became man in order that he might be man." And this is the kind of criticism, this is typical of his critique of Darwinism. Dismissive, you know, recall that the 19th century is his, one of his terms for the bundle of ideas that he doesn't like, that he thinks is old and stale and wrong and in opposition to what he sees as the 20th century ideas, the future, the ideas he likes. And the 19th century being petty statism. The 20th century ideas that he likes being the unity of the West. I think it's a false dichotomy, really, that he's setting up. He sets those things up in opposition to each other. But nationalism, which is what he argues the 19th century and is bad, and racialism, which he's arguing in favor of, unity as a race, are related to each other, not opposed to each other. They're complementary to each other. What he says here is teleology again. He thinks he's spotting teleology, and the mistake in reading his critique of Darwinism is accusing it of having teleology, you know, having imparting some direction. It's wrong to think that that means he thinks teleology is a bad thing. He's, as I said, he's just trying to arrogate it to the what he thinks where it belongs, with the ideas, not with man himself, but with the ideas that animate man. Physicists have come up with a phrase, I think, that better describes what he's getting at here, the point he's trying to make by saying man became man in order that he might be man. The physicists call that the anthropic principle, similar to anthropomorphism. Note the similar Latin roots there. But anthropic principle has a more subtle meaning, that basically man is only here to observe what's happening around him because the conditions make it possible for him to be here to observe. In other words, we wouldn't be observing what we're observing if the conditions weren't the way they are, if reality wasn't the way it is. And the anthropic principle itself is more of a cosmological, astronomical observation, looking at physical constants than it is biological here on Earth, based on those kind of observations as Darwinism is. But the two concepts, I think, are related to each other. And, you know, when one person accuses another of having a teleological flaw in their argument or in their worldview or something of nature, they're saying it as if it's an accusation, as if it's a flaw, as if it's something that's wrong with their argument. And the anthropic principle is more like an objective, that's just the way it is, way of seeing it, not putting a value judgment on it, really. It's natural that Englishmen saw themselves as the pinnacle of life, as the pinnacle of evolution, because after all, they were instrumental in deciphering it. And you could chalk it up to bigotry, but there it is. They did decipher the mechanics of life. And I think what Yaki, like many of the people who make this kind of man-monkey comparison throughout the history of the debate about Darwinism, are really reacting to and are really concerned about is that they're revolted by the idea that man and monkeys are related at some point in the past, that we are distant cousins in a sense. But the way I see it, without rejecting, you don't need to reject that reality. It seems to be a fact based on scientific observation and things that have been learned since Yaki's time, DNA, for example. But you can also see that man and monkey are similar in the sense that apples and oranges are similar, in that they're not very similar. They're similar in some ways and very dissimilar in others. The difference is consciousness. The difference is man can coordinate and communicate and has history and culture, whereas the apes, the monkeys, don't. Yaki writes a little further on, as a worldview, Darwinism cannot, of course, be refuted, since faith, with a capital F, is, always has been, and always will be, stronger than facts. Nor is it important to refute it as a picture of the world, since as such, it no longer influences any but day-before-yesterday thinkers. However, as a picture of the facts, it is grotesque, from its first assumptions to its last conclusions. Yaki is really down on Darwinism, and the reasons that he offers, the arguments against Darwinism, don't really make sense. It doesn't really explain to me, which is why I reach to try and understand it for unstated reasons, as I said, that his revulsion at the thought that man and monkey are related, or other reasons. But in this case, this particular argument that he uses, you could say that any worldview could be described as a faith, and so it can't be criticized because it or will always be stronger than facts. His own view of reality and the way what he thinks, how he thinks things work, you could describe as a faith that can't be argued against. And yet here he is arguing against it, and here I am arguing with him. Because that's what we do. We're trying to understand, trying to figure things out. The fact is that science is the least applicable system for that criticism, the least valid system to apply that kind of a criticism to, that it's just a faith. Because the whole nature of science is that it is objective, that it's not based on the word of one scientist as to what reality is. He makes observations, he describes his observations or his theories, and other scientists, other people who even aren't scientists, are free then to try to reproduce or to try to contradict those observations, those theories. That's how science works. It isn't faith. It's as far from faith as you can get, in fact. And that's Darwinism being based in science, as it is as far from faith as you can get. Now, he also takes issue with the struggle for existence, you know, the survival of the fittest. In the first place, there is no, quote, struggle for existence, unquote, in nature. This old Malthusian idea merely projected capitalism onto the animal world. Such struggles for existence as do occur are the exception. The rule in nature is abundance. There are plenty of plants for the herbivores to eat, and there are plenty of herbivores for the carnivores to eat. Between the latter, there can hardly be said to be a struggle, quote-unquote struggle, since only the carnivore is spiritually equipped for war. The capitalistic mentality, engaged in a competition to get rich, quite naturally pictured the animal world also as engaged in an intensive economic contest. Both Malthusianism and Darwinism are thus capitalistic outlooks, in that they place economics in the center of life and regard it as the meaning of life. This was an interesting observation I thought he was making here, to see he's basically accusing the men of the day, the social Darwinists, of projecting their own worldly materialistic concerns of their own surroundings onto all of nature, anthropomorphizing and projecting. I don't think that that's a valid observation. I think it's plausible. It certainly sounds reasonable. But when you think about it, capitalism, let's be honest, is something man-made. It's one of these ideas that's driven by man. It does not exist on its own. It does not have a will of its own. I know Yaki likes to pretend that these ideas do have a will of their own and an existence of their own, a direction of their own. But they don't. Men define what capitalism is. Men drive capitalism. And then capitalism sucks men into it too and perpetuates itself to a certain degree. But it's a two-way street at the very least. It's not a one-way thing where capitalism decides what happens. And thus, like everything else that's life-related or created by life, springs from life, or even just related back and forth, in a back and forth with life, as capitalism is subject to the same constraining forces that life is. Nature, and the constraints of nature. So that would be, I think, the source of the similarity between the capitalist competition and what's going on in nature. Now, Yaki, when he says only the carnivore is spiritually equipped for war, he himself is projecting there. He's anthropomorphizing onto the carnivore in general, the unconscious carnivore. But it's only man who is conscious. And the struggle for existence is only a conscious struggle in the mind of man. It's different from men amongst men or men struggling against the other life forms. Only man is really aware of this on that level. The other life forms, the herbivores and the carnivores, he's right in a sense that you can't say that they're struggling with each other. They're not conscious of the struggle with each other. And it is man sort of projecting his own consciousness of a struggle onto those unconscious life forms. But there is a competition in the sense that the resources are limited, contrary to Yaki's assertion that abundance is the rule. Resources are limited, and there's a need to survive and reproduce, and the different forms of life push against each other. It's a zero-sum game. If one form of life uses the resources, then it's not available for other forms of life, even though there are predator and prey relationships where one can grow and its population grows and then provides more for a predator, there's still an overall limit to the number of organisms that can live in a certain environment. They call it carrying capacity in ecology. The rule of nature is abundance, he writes. No, it isn't. That's half of it. It's feast and it's famine. The rabbit population may boom for a time, and that may even cause the coyotes then to boom because their food supply is abundant. There's the time of feast. But then because the coyotes boom, they end up hunting the rabbits down and the rabbit population crashes. And then what happens? The coyote population crashes. That's the famine half of the cycle. And the cycle repeats. This predator-prey boom and bust cycle mirrors what's going on in economics, and it's not a projection of capitalism onto nature to observe this actually happening in nature. It's not a figment of some greedy materialist rationalists onto nature. It's what it's actually happening. It's a fact. It's an observable fact of reality. And that's what Darwinism is. It's an observation of the rules of the reality of life. And specifically, how nature, how the environment shapes and molds life. But also, and this is a key point that I think a lot of people overlook, how the various forms of life shape each other, how the existence of one form of life alters the existence of another form of life. And that's where we get the concept of competition, competing. It's not all competition. In some cases, it's symbiosis. It's a cooperation in life, not a competition. Yaki writes, natural selection was the name given to the process by which the quote unfit died out to give place to the quote fit. He's critiquing that terminology there, but it's not a value judgment, this idea of fitness in Darwinism. It's merely observing that the metric of life, which is a completely objective metric, is survival. You either survive or you don't. As a species, you survive or you don't. And fitness has connotations of being healthy and strong and all of that. And that does correlate to the idea of fitness in Darwinism, but it's more like the fit of clothing, really, to the body, or the fit of a glove to the hand. It has more to do with the way life seems to adapt and match the terrain, the environment in which it finds itself. And if the environment shifts and changes, then the life itself may take a while, but it also then shifts and conforms. And imagine rabbits and coyotes elbowing each other for space. I'm anthropomorphizing there. It's difficult to avoid doing, being a flawed human being as I am. But the fact is that the ultimate metric of life is survival. And for a species, not just for an individual, for a species, survival over the long term. And here we come to, I think, another reason I think Yaki takes issue with Darwinism. And I'm guessing about this, but I think it's a reasonable guess. The fact is that Jews have outcompeted Europeans, have outcompeted whites, and they rule us. And they are slowly killing us. And most of us, like rabbits or coyotes, are unconscious of this. We're not even aware that it's happening. The Jews, for the most part, are. They are much more aware. And so Yaki, perhaps sensing this or maybe even conscious of it himself, saw survival of the fittest as bogus. His team wasn't winning. And so therefore survival of the fittest couldn't possibly be right. And it had to go. That's my suspicion. That's why I think a lot of people have a problem with Darwinism, racialists. They don't want to accept that, and they don't think that it is a reflection of our lack of fitness that we're ruled over by Jews. And it isn't. We can control that. We have something to say about it. We have to be conscious of it to do something.